The course of history might have changed had the first officer aboard the Titanic changed course and ordered hard starboard 30 seconds before he did. That moment of indecision sent the world's largest passenger liner on a collision course with an iceberg, which of course took 1,500 lives. This is according to a new study conducted for the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic. First Officer William Murdoch held his course too long once the iceberg had been spotted, according to the authors of a new book called Report into the Loss of the SS Titanic, A Centennial Reappraisal. The new take on what happened on April the 15th, 1912, contradicts the 1912 Wreck Commission verdict, which found Murdoch could not avoid the iceberg because it had been spotted too late. The latest study and book is the result of a collaboration between researchers and Titanic experts from around the world, including one from New Zealand. Longtime Titanic researcher Sam Halpern led the study, and Sam also helped write the book. Sam Halpern is on the line with us now from Chicago. Sam, hello.
How you doing?
A soberly titled book, so you've avoided the semblance of any sensationalism through the title, and that was part of the idea. This is a clear-eyed reappraisal, Sam.
That's correct. We decided to write this book to try and set the record straight based on basically almost 100 years of information that has come out since the 1912 sinking, and information that was not available in 1912 when the two major inquiries took place, the one being the American inquiry and the second being the British inquiry. And even then, there was a lot of testimony and evidence presented, but they just did not have the time to actually analyze all of the evidence very fully in order to meet certain deadlines for them to issue their reports. We have the benefit, of course, of 100 years of hindsight now, in addition to additional discoveries, such as the discovery of the wreck site, which took place in 1985. Plus, there were some uncovered documents that were unavailable at the time of the 1912 inquiries that are currently available to us as well today.
Right, got you. So 100 years of information, as you say, Sam, and a year in the making, this book. Did you set out, even in the back of your mind, to show that Murdoch didn't change course in time, and we'll get to what happened, or did you just let the facts take you where they led?
Well, actually, I let the facts take me where it led. I did not have any pre-thought in terms of what I would find or what conclusions we would come to, but we had a wealth of evidence that we needed to consider. In 1912, the majority of, in 1912, the major conclusion about the particular accident itself, the seconds before the collision, came primarily from Titanic's surviving fourth officer, Joseph Boxall. And a lot of what Boxall said seemed to be very... it just didn't add up when one tried to figure out how is it possible for him to observe everything he said he observed or heard everything he said he heard in the short time that he said it was from the time he came out on deck from the officers' quarters until the time the collision actually took place.
Okay. Whereas you have looked at other individuals in this.
We looked at other individuals, and we did not try to weight anyone's testimony at a higher level than anyone else.
I understand.
Which I do not think was the case in 1912. They tended to take the testimony of a higher rank official, like an officer or a sea captain, above that of somebody that was of lower rank.
For example, Frederick Fleet, the lookout, Robert Hitchens, the sailor at the wheel, Alfred Oliver, who left his post when he heard the bells and reached the bridge as the ship struck the iceberg. So can we go through what you have found that contradicts some of our knowledge of what happened 100 years ago? First of all, the crucial question, Sam, of how far out they saw the iceberg when the Titanic was steaming towards it.
Yes, British Recommission report concluded it was about 1,500 feet out in front. They based that on evidence that was given by the naval architect from Harland and Wolff, that was Edward Wilding, who told them that they performed an experiment on Titanic's sister ship, Olympic, whereby when they gave the order hard to starboard, it took the Olympic about 37 seconds to turn 2 points to port, which was what the evidence was given to them by Hitchens, who was at the wheel, that Titanic turned 2 points to port when she struck. And so the commission says, okay, if Olympic took 37 seconds at pretty much the same speed that Titanic was going, almost the same speed, we could assume Titanic took 37 seconds as well. And then they allowed for maybe 3 seconds worth of time for, you know, from when the warning was given to time when the order was given to actually make the turn. And the problem with that, as I point out in the book, is when you read the evidence that was given to the Recommission report, including by Hitchens and Fleet and Oliver and everybody else, they themselves, even though they acknowledged that the lookouts, you know, called down on the phone to the wheelhouse and indicated what it is that they saw ahead, none of the time for even a phone call was allowed in their calculation of their, let's say, 40 seconds, which determined their 1,500 feet distance. So they didn't even take into account evidence that was given directly to them that they should have in order to figure out the actual sighting distance of the iceberg. And I point this out in the book as well.
Yes, but why not? Because 40 seconds is a glaringly large amount of time. And you explain why the 40 seconds, but why didn't they report it to the original inquiry?
Okay, well, in the 40 seconds that the original inquiry assumed, they allowed maybe 3 seconds for Murdoch to realize what was happening and then give an order, and then they allowed 37 seconds for the ship to actually make the turn. And what I decided to do is take a totally different approach, and I said, okay, I understand where they came from, and I understand the mistake they made in not allowing even time for a phone call to take place in between. Yeah. So it had to be more, it had to have been certainly more than 40 seconds anyway. So is there other evidence that we could use to get a better judgment as to how much time was it from the sighting until the time of collision? And by the sighting, I mean the time when the lookout struck the three bells warning, which was probably a few seconds after the lookouts themselves had actually spotted the iceberg. And then what we find is when you go through the evidence, you find that the quartermaster Hitchens, who was at the wheel, said that the order for him to turn the wheel took place about a half a minute after the three bell warning. And that's a delay right there, which struck me and said, that's odd. Why a half a minute of delay before you even tell the quartermaster or order the quartermaster to turn away? And then when you read the testimony of Fleet, who was up in the lookout in that last nest and actually was the one who called down on the phone, they asked him as well, how long were you on the phone from the time that you had given your warning about after you struck the warning bell? See, he estimated that he was on or at the phone about a half a minute. Now, I realize when somebody says a half a minute, it's a judgment call. It could have been 20 seconds, 25 seconds, 30. And maybe a lot of people are putting too much into the 30 seconds, is taking it as a precise number. But certainly the fact that both of these independently, these people independently testified a half a minute, delayed, at the phone before the ship even started to turn away, says something took place between the warning bell, which kept Murdoch from initially, shouting out hard a starboard immediately. So the point that came to me said, it apparently that Murdoch did not react with a knee-jerk reaction. What he had to do, if he did not spot the iceberg prior to the three-bell warning, once he heard the three-bell warning, the first thing he would have done is look straight ahead, because three bells meant that an object was sighted ahead of the ship, yeah, as opposed to off the port bow or the starboard bow, but somewhere ahead of the ship. And my guess is that Murdoch saw the iceberg once he looked up, probably took time to put his binoculars up to the berg and focus on it to see what it is that is the lookout struck the bell for. It could have been a derelict vessel. It didn't necessarily mean an iceberg, but he didn't know that at the time. So it was a few seconds in just looking at what it is that he actually sighted.
Yes, and he makes a judgment call, as to whether he's going to miss that iceberg, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And the other piece of evidence, which I talk about briefly in the book, actually, it's actually in a end note that I put it in. It's in a different article, which I wrote some time back. Frederick Fleet, years ago, was once asked if he could draw a little sketch of just exactly what it was he sighted at the time he sighted the iceberg. And in the sketch that Fleet actually drew, which showed the bow of the ship and all that as it would look from high up in the crow's nest, he didn't put the iceberg dead ahead in line with the bow, but he put it off slightly to the starboard side. He put it off the starboard bow of the ship, so the peak of the berg was slightly off to the starboard side. And I thought about that, and I said, if the berg was not dead ahead, and when he called on the phone, he didn't say dead ahead. He said the iceberg right ahead, which is it means a little different thing. If Murdoch saw that this object was not dead ahead but slightly off to the right, the first thing he probably did was see whether or not the ship was going to collide with it. And the only way you could see whether there could be a collision is to wait a few seconds to see if the bearing line to this object remains the same or is opening up. If the bearing line starts to open up to the right, that means you're not going to collide, you're not on a collision course, and you're going to pass it. You may come close to it, but you should be, you should safely pass it if the bearing line opens up. But you need to give yourself a few seconds to make that judgment call. I'm also, by the way, a private pilot, so I know when we spot another aircraft in the air, and we always were taught that if the bearing line to the other aircraft that you see is changing, is moving either left or right, and does not remain the same, you're not on a collision course. If it is remaining the same, you better make a turn to avoid, because you are on a collision course.
And all of that makes sense.
So it all makes sense. Yeah.
So why did the original inquiry de-emphasize the amount of time it took Murdoch? Was it partly, to make a decision, which is eminently sensible, as you describe? Was it partly because he was a hero of the sinking? They didn't want to make it look as if he was a ditherer of some sort?
I think it really is. It's two things. One is that they gave a great weight to what Fourth Officer Boxall had to say. And if you look at Boxall's timeline, everything occurred within maybe 15 seconds, including from the time the three bells struck until the ship actually, the three bells from the lookout were struck until the ship actually collided with the iceberg. Because he only had to walk 60 feet to come onto the bridge. And he said he was just coming out of the officer's quarters, and we know exactly where that was, when he heard the three bells, and then he only came as far as the Captain Smith's quarters ahead, which is maybe 40 feet ahead of that point before he came on the bridge when he felt the ship actually strike the iceberg. And, we know 60, 60 feet, even at a normal pace of walking, should take you no more than maybe 15 seconds. So if we believe everything Boxall said, the whole thing occurred within 10 seconds, and he'd even give enough time for the ship to turn, you know, off of its course before it struck. So there was something that didn't make sense about it from a timeline point of view from what he said. But again, he was the senior, he was the surviving officer that was on the watch at the time that Titanic struck, and his testimony was given a great amount of weight by the Wreck Commission. And I suppose, and this is purely speculation on my part, that the Wreck Commission just would not believe that somebody, that a ship's officer, would delay very long in issuing an order to avoid an object that was spotted right ahead.
Whereas you actually think it was eminently sensible that he did delay. He needed to appraise what was ahead.
Well, what I think colored my thinking was looking back over Murdoch's career. Unfortunately, Murdoch did not survive to testify, so we don't know exactly what happened. But you could get a sense of what this man was like by actions that took place, you know, beforehand that had been documented. And one of those was, I think it was in 1903, when he was second officer on the Arabic. He was taken over at the time, just about trying to relieve the first officer, which I think his name was Fox, from the wheel, when they also received a warning from their lookout that a vessel was crossing their bows. And the Arabic would have been on a collision course with this vessel. The officer of the watch, the first officer, issued an order to turn the ship to port. He actually called something like hard a port, again trying to turn the ship away from the object that was crossing. And Murdoch was watching the situation, unfold, and Murdoch was able to figure out that the worst thing he could do was turn the ship away, which would actually cause a collision. So he actually pushed, according to the story now, this is an alleged story, he pushed the helmsman away and grabbed the wheel and held the wheel steady so the ship would not turn at all, and in so doing, he avoided a collision. And in thinking about that, I said, here's a man that didn't just react out of what we call instinct. It was just he waited to assess the situation, give it a few seconds, see what's happening, and then take appropriate action. And in the case of the Arabic, he took the appropriate action.
In this case, in the case of the Titanic, even if he had taken swifter action, would that have changed much? I mean, humanly, could he have been much faster than he was, Sam?
Well, I mean, you could only play the game and say, well, what happens if he would have immediately, said hot to stop it as soon as the lookout bell warning was given? And that would have maybe saved 30, and that probably would have been enough to miss it. I'm trying to remember if I actually did a run on my model to see whether or not the ship would miss by, if it was just 30 seconds sooner. I think it would have. It would have just cleared. The danger is if you are too close to the object, even if it's off your starboard bow by a little bit, turning away will swing your stern out, because the ship does not turn like an automobile. It turns differently. It turns by the stern swinging out away in the direction away from the turn that you're making. And the chances would have been, if he waited, longer, if he didn't wait as long as he did, the stern itself would have smacked into the berg. He got to a point where he realized that a collision was unavoidable, and the question if we were going to have a collision, what's the best way to take it?
Yeah.
A lot of people said maybe he should have not turned at all and let the ship hit, bow on, And, of course, we know now, at least according to the naval architects from Holland and Wolff, they estimated that the ship would have survived the head-on collision. But, you know, people just don't do that. You know, if you could avoid a collision and, you know, have the, you know, try and take it on the side rather than bow on, which would have crushed the entire bow about, you know, a couple hundred feet back, and obviously killed all the firemen and trimmers that, you know, lived in the forecastle. You just don't, you know, you don't want to do that. So maybe we're only speculating here. Maybe his point, once he realized he had to do something, was to say, let it hit along the starboard side. Maybe we'll be lucky. It'll be a glancing blow, which it turned out to be, and avoid significant damage in the rear, which would have opened up where the engine rooms and boiler rooms are, and possibly, you know, that would have, my guess, would have caused the ship to go down in a lot sooner time.
Yes. Report into the loss of the SS Titanic, a centennial reappraisal. Mm-hmm. And Sam Halpern is with us. Just before we leave, the question of Murdoch and his judgment, mm-hmm. and you're pretty kind on him in the book. It's certainly a drastic reappraisal from James Cameron's portrayal of him in the film, isn't it?
Well, that's true. I'd rather not comment on how Cameron portrayed Murdoch in the film. It was a film, you know, and there, you know, people who make films, you know, have artistic license and they do what they like to do.
Yeah.
Our view is to try and look at the facts as best we could find out and portray what we think actually was the case.
I know, but it's pretty sensational having him commit suicide, having shot two people trying to storm a lifeboat.
Yeah, and there's really no hard evidence that actually took place.
No, he probably fired shots into the air to stop other people storming lifeboats, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. And he wasn't the only one to fire shots in the air. Fifth Officer Lowe fired a couple of shots as well by Lifeboat 14.
We don't have time to deal with the chapter in which it said you come into your forensic own, I read in a report, about the Californian and whether it failed to respond to distress signals. And you have a lot of sympathy for the captain of that boat. Can I ask you to summarize that briefly? Because that's an aspect of the Titanic sinking that a lot of people have heard of also.
Yeah, a lot of people have heard of it. And I think the truth of the matter is that there's... Today, there is no dispute about the fact that Californian had seen the distressed rockets from Titanic. We know that for a fact. Even if you allow for California being where her captain thought she was, and it wasn't, it was actually more south from that, the rockets had to have been seen. I mean, nobody's disputing that any longer, ever since the wreck site was discovered. Where the dispute is these days with regard to the Californian was just how far away was she, and was there a third ship that came in between Titanic and Californian, which made the people on Californian not realize that what they were looking at was a ship in distress. And that controversy still exists. There are still many sympathizers that are insisting that a third ship came in between, and then it actually sailed off after the rockets ceased firing. And what I try to show is, from a forensic point of view, why that's not the case, and show that the original position of Californian, as given by her captain, was not correct, that it had to have been on a line of bearing from Titanic, based on what the crew members themselves had measured in terms of the angle that the rockets were coming from. It had to have been on a line which made Californian much further south. And then I went through some additional evidence, even submitted by Captain Lord himself, that showed that he was under the influence of the cold Labrador current, which moves from north to south, since approximately 4 p.m. in the afternoon until he stopped at almost 10:30 in the evening, and even after that he was being set south all along, and which would explain how he got to a position much closer than he thought he was. We put the ship Californian about between 12 and 14 miles from Titanic.
Yes, and you explained that situation very well.
Yes.
And to a large extent exonerate the captain of the Californian, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, he made some mistakes, but the biggest mistake is he should have gotten out and up on deck when he heard that there has been some report of a rocket seen. Even if he was told of one rocket, he probably should have just gone up. But, you know, like everything else, it's so easy to blame somebody well after the fact and, you know, what they do at the time things occur.
It's a fascinating and complete piece of scholarship, and a lot of brains and expertise have gone into it. Congratulations, Sam, and thank you very much for spending us the time talking about the book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.